We're asking you, our listeners, to sign the, quote, "I support the sacred," end quote, petition to show your support for Apache Stronghold's legal case to protect Oak Flat.
Resolution Copper, a subsidiary of British and Australian mining giants Rio Tinto and BHP, proposes to completely destroy this sacred site and contaminate the surrounding land, water, and air. Preserving the religious liberty of Apache peoples is essential to preserving our own.
We must all join together to protect sacred land from the forces of destruction. You can find the link to the petition in the show notes. Thank you.
The Doctrine of Discovery is the current system of laws and policies that justify the removal of land from Indigenous peoples. These laws are rooted in church doctrines that originated in the 15th century.
Together, we will uncover this deep structure of colonization that systematically deprives Indigenous peoples of human rights.
I'm Sherry Hostetler, and I help start a coalition of Anabaptist people of faith that seek to dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery. I'm also a Mennonite pastor in San Francisco.
And I'm Sarah Augustine, and I also help start this coalition. As an activist and scholar, I'm the descendant of the Tewa people and a displaced person. This is the Dismantling the Doctrine of Discovery podcast.
It's my great privilege and pleasure this morning to introduce my friend, Patrick Bell. Pat is the Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of East Oregon. He is a champion for Indigenous people's rights. He's led the charge within his own diocese to dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery. And he is also the father of three Indigenous children, two stepchildren, and the grandfather of more than 10 grandchildren, I think maybe even two great-grandchildren. Pat, it's such a pleasure to have you here this morning, and we're so excited to hear about your work and all that you are doing and about.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's a real privilege to be with you both.
I have a question that I didn't say I was going to ask you, but how long have you two known each other?
Well, let's see if we can agree on that. Probably over 2 years. Mm. Probably closer to 2.5 is all.
Well, this kind of leads into the question I did want to ask you, Pat, which is what motivated you to repudiate the Doctrine of Discovery as a diocese?
The quick answer is the land. Mm-hmm. And so let me explain that. And that kind of comes in two different epochs of my life. I think... thinking about the question that you posed gave me a chance to think about where that all begins for me. It goes back to my growing up on a farm and spending an awful lot of time, thousands and thousands and thousands of days and hours on land that my family had farmed. I was sixth generation, and not much awareness about who was there before us, but I spent so many times and moments on that sacred ground that, this may sound strange to particularly to white ears, I think in some ways, but the land spoke, and I developed a deep, deep connection to that space and to land. And it has continued to ground to me, no pun intended, although it's very true, into the future. And so that, I think, is really where my journey starts, being deeply aware of the sacredness of space. And so when I came back to the diocese 7.5 years ago as bishop, we have some property in our northeast corner that houses not only our camp, but now our diocesan offices. And we have some land that's been being farmed for by the first colonial settlers in the mid-1800s. And so it's been farmed up until I became bishop. And as I looked out over that land, I just began to have some vision about what we might do with that. And at the time, we had two people working with us in our camp and diocese youth ministry, Bobby and Brosnan. And they continued to be partners with us in the work, but Bobby was doing some work around the camp for maintenance and all and groundskeeping. And he and I began to walk this the land that was being farmed, and we began to dream. And he began to tell me his vision for cultural revitalization, particularly from his heritage with the Cayuse and other Umatilla confederated clans and tribes. And as the more we talked and Bobby talked about particularly First Foods and cultural revitalization, it just grew in me with my love of the land to say, why don't we take these acreages and turn them back to their, as much as we can, to their original condition. And so we pulled it out of the farming system and began to develop the project that we still have going to this day, which is to return that space to native plants and particularly to First Foods. And Bobby and Brosnan continue to oversee much of that as a part of what they call caretakers of the land and their cultural revitalization work. So really, that's where it began. It's kind of interesting because having started from that, it's almost backwards. We started with a real concrete project. But the more we did that, the more we suddenly looked at each other and said, if we're going to do this, we really need to go back to the beginning. And the beginning for us was to look back, and particularly as a religious organization, to recognize our responsibility to repudiate the beginnings of our contact with indigenous peoples in this continent and around the world, by repudiating the Christian doctrine of discovery. So we kind of, while we're doing that and doing some practical real work, we said, let's go back and educate ourselves and address our beginnings. So that's really what led us to that.
Thank you. I really identified. I did not grow up in a farm and on a farm, although my parents were and grandparents and ancestors were all farmers before that. But I grew up with a deep love of the land. And I feel like that is also the basis of my own story about getting involved with this. So I thank you for that. I really appreciated you naming that.
You're welcome.
Well, I wonder if you'd be willing to tell us, Pat, about the repudiation story. This is quite an undertaking for an entire diocese. And I know our listeners are really going to be interested to hear, what was that like? How did you do it, and how did it go?
Well, I'll start with the last and move backwards. Maybe it actually went. To be honest, I still am a bit surprised, if not in shock, how supportive the diocese ended up being. And Sarah was with us a year ago in 22. When we actually presented what was a good 4 years worth of work. We tasked a group of people who expressed their willingness and interest to help us do the hard work of study and learning that, frankly, I was not aware of. I have to be very honest that I honestly, until probably 6-7 years ago, myself, I was not aware of the doctrine and where it all began for us, particularly in the U.S. Christian movement. And so to begin that work for all of us from almost ground level, it took us 4 years to develop what we thought was a helpful, thorough, truthful claiming of our part with that and what had happened. And so when we finally got to the point of presenting that in 22 to our convention as a resolution asking the entire diocese to do that, it was a unanimous decision. And I wasn't expecting that. So I was gratified that maybe some of the work we had done had communicated to people the seriousness and importance of what we were trying to do. And that was couched. I guess one thing I should say about this, what also moved us toward this effort was our Episcopal Church on the national level with our presiding Bishop Michael Curry had, from the beginning of his movement as presiding bishop for the church, to put forward the concept of, as a man of color, particularly working out of the civil rights movements of the 60s and some of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s work around beloved community. So he started really highlighting our work to be followers of Jesus in the way of love and becoming beloved community. And as we began to try to embrace that, Michael was elected to that position just before I came in as bishop. So I've kind of been a part of that. We looked around and said, how do we engage beloved community? And it struck me, particularly having grown up with the awarenesses I did have about Indigenous people's plight, we looked around our diocese and said, where do we begin with beloved community? And how do we reach those people who are most ostracized and on the margins? And realize that, that at least my growing up and looking around, it always seems like it's Indigenous people who never either get mentioned or recognized, they're just almost dropped off and forgotten like they never existed. And so as we looked at that, we said, if we're going to highlight beloved, becoming a beloved community, and if we're going to gather and say we're extending our arms of love and respect to everybody, we should start with those on the very kind of outer edges of that. And for us, and particularly in terms of people of color most predominant in Eastern Oregon, it would become our Indigenous neighbors and siblings.
Yeah. I'm curious about, you said that, you know, you took this, well, I guess I want to get back to that, the first act, which was the concrete action of taking land that was diocesan land that had been used for farming, but now was turned over to cultural revitalization and First Foods. Did I summarize that correctly? Was that what happened? Mm-hmm. So was there any resistance to that, action?
You know, there was a little bit, particularly from the old guard. There were a group of particularly predominantly men who had overseen a lot of that effort over the last several decades. And there was, and it took some work to convince them that, for them, it was kind of like everything else we face in terms of a lot of Indigenous issues, especially it's all about where the capital gains come. You know, where's the money going to come and who's after that? Once I convinced them that we weren't making any money on the farm anyway, it made it easier. But there was some, but that passed pretty quickly and people really began to. In fact, it took off so quickly with that, way before we even began some of the discussions around the doctrine work, that I think that actually paved the way for our work for the repudiation to be so well received at a year ago.
I was just thinking of that I wondered how much taking the action first actually made it easier than to do the sort of deep theological kind of educational groundwork that you ended up doing. One more follow-up question, because I think some of our listeners will be interested in knowing how you did this as a diocese. Was there did you come up with a curriculum that you then gave out to all of the congregations and asked them to do that? Or how did you actually do that educational work among a far-flung diocese?
That's a really good question, Gary. To be honest, no, we didn't have a curriculum. Part of our resolution we passed unanimously includes the fact that now we're trying to work and develop the curriculum to get it out. So again, we're kind of doing things maybe a bit backwards. But I think how we got it out was both We're a relatively small diocese. We don't have a lot of people, a lot of space. We cover about, close to two-thirds, if not three-quarters of the diocese, and of the state of Oregon. So it's a lot of space with very few of us engaged in this work. But I think there's a significant level of trust of people for each other, and those people we selected for the commission, what was a committee and became our commission, our Truth and Conciliation Commission. I think their effort just really paid off in speaking to people out in the congregations. And then I do have to say, and I say this with the greatest gratitude and respect of Sarah, I think having Sarah at that convention and her speaking, she just touched people's hearts so deeply. I think that made a huge difference. The work that she did with us leading up to that convention and then being present with people made all the difference.
So, Sherry, one of the things that I want to highlight here is the Truth and Conciliation Commission as a body, I think, is really important in this story. And of course, Pat, this is your story, and I know just a little bit of it, but what it is organizing in a way that our coalition often organizes, which is rather than making a unilateral decision, engaging a team of people to engage the question and to be responsible for communicating to the rest of the body what is learned. And that Truth and Conciliation Commission, which I think, Pat, is geographically diverse, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Lay leaders and includes some priests as well as lay leaders really did some tough grappling and work. And, you know, I just think it's such a good example of sharing that, that I don't know what to say. It's a burden, but also joy of building community around important spirit-led work. And I've just really so enjoyed working with the commission.
I appreciate that, Sarah. I think that's helpful. The other thing I would say is that the commission itself wasn't always easy. There were a couple of moments in which we came to some really tough places where, you know, I think our initial work, I was so impressed and I learned so much from these people working together. But the truth telling, you know, we really made a commitment to try to be bold and unafraid to confront our own issues and the history. And yet there were some moments when we'd have something might be said by a member of that commission that we kind of came back to confront a bit, to address maybe is a better word to talk about. And they created some real tension. But what was fascinating about that is it taught us that this is not going to be easy with everybody. And even those who have done the reading and really are committed, we still have all of us work to do. And I guess I would point out over the last several years, even frankly, in this last month, I've realized how much work I still have to do around this issue.
Mm. Pat, I really appreciate your humility and your honesty about this. I mean, honestly, when Sarah asked me to, start a coalition with her, I didn't know a lot about the Doctrine of Discovery. I started a coalition and learned as I went. And I'm also aware of, I think sometimes people feel like they have to be like, experts at something before they begin, and you don't have to be. You learn by doing, and you learn by mistakes made and confronting your own lack of awareness and confront. I just really appreciate your honesty about what that process entailed. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, can I say one thing about that follow up on it? You know, recognize my modus operandi in the past has always been, if I don't know it or if I can't do it the best, I probably won't do it. And this process has really helped me, even in my older period of life to recognize, you know what, I don't have to get it all right. And I can enter in this with a certain level of playfulness and honesty. And one of the things that one of our partners, who Sarah knows down the Warm Springs, has said in some of the work that she's been doing and leading with us, is to enter into this with a certain, with a deep level of inquiry and both a sense of imagination entering into it, but being willing to just ask questions and explore and recognizing that we don't have it all and we're never going to get it all, but let's get what we can and keep moving. And it makes it such a delight to be able to walk with people in that spirit.
I'm wondering if I want to ask another follow-up question, which is, how did you feel like you had to deal a lot with what I guess I call white guilt? And the way that sometimes that guilt over, I mean, where I see it is sort of progressive people of faith who know that there were great harms done and feel so almost like personally guilty about that, that it actually kind of keeps them from entering into the work. Or when they do, it's very tentatively, with like being afraid they're going to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. And so it kind of keeps them from this full throated, hearted entry into the work. And I'm just curious if you dealt with that at all or saw that in yourself even.
Absolutely. I have, Sherry, same thing. And, you know, early on really struggling with that. And Sarah, once again, was our prophet of speaking truth to this. Yes. And our group remembers her saying this to us, that, you know, guilt doesn't accomplish anything. It just, we get stymied by guilt. And, you know, it's all about us. It's so selfish to be guilty. And nothing comes out of it. And so we've tried, and as we did at our convention, and I've never asked Sarah what she thought about that, actually. So if she wants to speak truth to this, even on this podcast, I'd be happy to hear it. But so we started our last convention with trying to change it from guilt to grief. And so we started our worship service with a lament, and to try to focus people to say, you know, we speak the truth, we name it, and we claim our part in it, but now what do we do with that? And the grief is that we haven't done enough and we have much more to do, but let's get to it. And so I've so appreciated that learning to quit wallowing in the guilt, because that we deal with that so much here as well, and it's counterproductive.
Pat, I love that. I love the pivot towards grief and lament. And I reviewed, as you know, that lament, that beautiful, moving lament that you wrote. One thing I didn't mention in your when I introduced you that I wish I would have is what a gifted preacher you are. You're really a very powerful speaker, and a kind and gentle pastor. You know, and so I think that pivot to lament is so important in terms of processing, like helping to process and not get stuck. So processing those deep feelings, because guilt, I think, is really a combination of anger and fear. It's sort of anger that's turned inward. And so, you know, one of the things we talk about in the coalition is saying, hey, I want to show up. I'm going to show up as a representative of my ancestors. I'm alive. I have the ability to show up now in a good way. How do I want to show up? And I mean, it's, I just have admired so much the way that in your work that your community is showing up.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for that. I wrote down, it's so selfish to be guilty, because I just, and even as I say that, I'm afraid that some of my guilty people will be like, oh no, now I'm selfish too, on top of being guilty. But it is, it's like, it's how do you turn away from, it is a very inward self-focused thing. And I think what I say sometimes to folks is, you know, all of us were born into these systems even if we sometimes are disproportionately privileged by them, but they actually dehumanize all of us. None of us wanted this. But now this is, but this is the world we landed in. So now what do we do? And I feel like sometimes that has helped people, because I think sometimes white people just hear like, oh, I'm the oppressor. I got so much privilege and benefit from this. And there is truth in that. But it is also a dehumanizing system for everybody involved in it. And we don't want it. Our heart's deepest desire is not this. Our heart's deepest desire is for God's shalom. And so maybe that is another way. Maybe that grief is just the lament over how broken, how far we have fallen from the dream of God and from our own deepest dreams for what we want in the world. So a calling back to that goodness, I think, and that deep desire seems to speak to people also.
Oh, that's really powerful. I appreciate that very much, Sherry. That's so true.
Well, and that actually gets into my next question, which I feel like you've answered in a variety of ways, but what is the sort of the theological or faith grounding from which you operate? Like what is that? Yeah. What is your sort of your theological, spiritual faith motivations to do the work you've done?
I think I go back to claiming a part of our Episcopal tradition, which is what we call the baptismal covenant that was created with the renewal of some of our liturgical materials back in the 1970s. And in that baptismal covenant, we talk about the fact that, that there are five questions that we pose, particularly to the whole community, but especially around a baptismal service, is to remind us who we are and what commitments we made or were made on our behalf in our baptism. And one of those is to talk about respecting the dignity of every human being. And having rehearsed that over and over and over in my almost 50 years of ordained ministry and life within the Episcopal Church, having grown up in it, although I haven't been ordained the total time in the Episcopal Church, I took a little stint off with some Pentecostals for a while, but came back. And I find that rehearsing that over and over, I think it's finally working. I think I'm finally being formed into that, that I want to be someone who respects the dignity of every human being. So I hope that's the basis on all of my relationships with people. And certainly this work is a key piece of that. I will say that one of the places that I'm kind of a late bloomer, which is probably true about most of my life, I think, as I tend to be slow in learning things, but coming to the place of real justice work. And I would be thrilled to say that I've been really engaged in works of particularly around racial justice for all of that ministry. But I haven't. That's kind of a late piece for me to really claim that. But a lot of it is about looking for where is the justice for people within my work to respect the dignity of every person means I need to do something about the dignity of people.
Thank you.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Pat, how has being the father of Indigenous children impacted your journey here with the doctrine of discovery and also just with Indigenous people's work?
That's what got me to thinking a lot about family. Even back, I of course began that in college by falling in love with an Indigenous woman, a Yakima. But a woman who at the age of five had been taken along with her other four siblings off the reservation and all of them placed into foster homes. Her mother was struggling. She was, you know, from all the issues that were not her, you know, we're back to, I think, Sherry, what you were talking about, the natural goodness of people. And I think her mother was just caught in all of those places that Indigenous people get caught when they're stripped of dignity and livelihood and connection to the land and to the past. Anyhow, her mother was just not able to take care of her five children. So my first wife was placed with one of her older sisters in a white home. Wonderful Christian couple, great people, and wanting to do good. They had two of their own daughters, older, and brought in these two girls, whom they later adopted as adults. But I still remember the first thing that Danielle was her name. Said that the first thing she remembers coming into that home is her mother, her new foster mother, cutting her hair and then trying to dress her up, make her look as white as she could. But at the same time, they were doing good work as white Christians to take in these two kids. And this is, of course, 1958, 59. So, it was a different day and age, but it's, you know, it's the part of that story. And so she was one totally disconnected from her culture and her family. And so one of the things I've looked at is recognizing my children never had that advantage. Their mother began to rediscover and reconnect through actually our work with the Episcopal Church, the kids being so disconnected from their culture because their mother was disconnected that's part of my lament today. My youngest daughter was able to engage some of that as her mother also reconnected in later life in the 90s. And so my younger daughter became a fancy dancer and began to do some work and study and reconnect. And she eventually became enrolled in the Yakima tribe. And then my other older daughter followed suit. And so they both now are enrolled. But there's still just a disconnect. You know, there's just for them, I want to give them the opportunity if they want to be able to reconnect with that deep piece of their culture that they can do it. And to do that, I need to support the work of revitalization and reclaiming space and culture as best I can to support that. So that's part of my drive. As I mentioned privately before we started this podcast, I also, in thinking that this question through, I realized that one of the pieces is my son. My son was... it was the oldest, ended up both because of genetics from both his father and his mother, ended up an alcoholic, started drinking in high school. And while he joined the Marines, that probably didn't help him much for some of those issues. But I look back and realize a young man who, when he came back out of the Marines, had some trouble, lived with me for quite a while. But ended up on the streets, his alcoholism and some mental illness, but also recognizing that this is very much a part of my discovery of my own son just before he died, was that he was probably of two spirits. He was struggling and he'd never, you know, I didn't know how to help him at that point when he was young, had no clue that he was discovering who he was. And he was just, his gender was an issue. And all of that. And what I came to understand, I think understand for him was, he was one of those caught in that in between stages between cultures and connection to people, to family. And had he had the opportunity to be able to connect more with his Indigenous side, I think that maybe he would have found health. And I think he would have known himself better. And the poor man died just never having found himself. and I didn't know how to help him. So some of my work is also to try to make sure that I can help any other young people, particularly if there's any opportunity for Indigenous young people to know that they are who God has created them, this great spirit has made them and called them. And I want them to be able to live that fully with dignity. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that vulnerable sharing, Pat. I'm thinking of how when we talk about the importance of the Indian Child Welfare Act and having Indigenous children remain connected to their Indigenous culture and heritage and land, if possible, we call that connection to their culture a protective factor. You know, it's, I assume that's sort of a social work term to talk about a protective factor. But the story you've told just fleshed out the reality of what a protective factor, I think what I heard you say is if my son had access to that connection, that would have been a protective factor in his life. It may have kept him from some of the roads he went down, or it might have been able to help heal him had he had more of that connection. So thank you for that vulnerable sharing, because I think it really it's just a tender story to show how important that is. Those protective factors are to be connected to one's culture and land and traditions. So thank you.
I want to comment also and say, also, thank you for sharing, Pat. And, I was a late bloomer as a parent and birthed the one child that I birthed at 36 for a reason, because I grew up in poverty and trauma and violence and all of that. that's part of my story. And I've written about that. But I think I married a person, my husband, who is upright and kind, had proven to be a good father. And, we raised our child in this bucolic setting without worry or care. And so, for me, I went through some hard years as a teen. I spent time on the street. And I remember just feeling this deep and sinking despair, just despair. And I think for all the reasons, having a very disrupted family, it was, disrupted by incarceration and drug abuse and all the things, but also just being rejected by the dominant culture. Like, it was just very clear to me that I was never going to be able to assimilate, that I was just, it was like there was a red flag. And, one of the things that was so challenging as an adolescent was just feeling so ugly, just not like the others. I know everybody struggles with that in adolescence, and teenagers are rude and cruel to each other. But I guess one of the things that didn't occur to me in my own parenting was that I felt like it was one household and one family, I could insulate my child from that. And I could not. My child, when my child started to experience despair in a way where they were willing to harm themselves, it was like deja vu all over again. What the heck? I feel like, what did we do wrong? I feel like we tried so hard to do everything right. How could this happen? And I think, for me as a parent, it was such a rookie mistake to think that one household could rehabilitate an entire society that is grounded in white supremacy. I can insulate a little child on our farm, but once that child is conscious of the world and able to see their place in it, they're dealing with the same disruption and dislocation and despair that I experienced. And that's where it's like, man, I am on the hook to work on justice at the structural level, because I cannot love one child out of this. This is a world that is hostile to my people. And, you know, I think that was so painful to learn that. And, you know, I've written about this, not ever about my own personal life, but definitely about living in the context of the reservation and recognizing the hard way, Pat, that just sort of being kind and loving to individuals was not going to cut it. It is not an antidote to oppression. You know, oppression has to be dismantled. And I just didn't think I was going to have to deal with that in my own life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I have had to deal with that. And so, you know, I appreciate you being willing to share. It's really meaningful to me as a parent because, man, I hear you. I mean, it's, you know, we have to struggle with the injustice that destroys hope and the dignity of our young. I mean, on the reservation, on the Yakima reservation, a teenager is 7 times more likely to commit suicide, a teenager on the reservation, than in other youth in the state of Washington. That's the Yakima reservation. And it's the second leading cause of death in youth. And so that's not going to go away by loving kindness. We have to address the systemic injustice for people to have dignity. I'm so thankful that you said dignity because I think that's the core. I really do. I am sorry I never had the chance to meet your son.
Well, thank you for all that, Sarah. That's very helpful to me. And it does make me think, which of course that leads into the next question quite well, doesn't it? That what are we going to do now with some of this in terms of addressing that? But I, before we maybe move and follow up with Sarah's beautiful segue into the, you know, what next steps might all of us take once we've made the statements about what we intend to do. I think one of the losses for my children as Indigenous is the loss of eldership, of the stabilizing influence, the teaching, the counsel, the guidance, the formation, the wisdom. And I didn't know what I was doing as a parent either, but I certainly didn't know how to help my Indigenous children, or even I wasn't even aware that they were being caught. I wasn't conscious enough to know that genetically, deep down in their DNA, they were living in a conflicted world between two different cultures. And to somehow bring that to the fore, if I could have said that to my children, particularly to my son, and said, I need to help you in a different way, because I was doing everything I knew, having grown up as a privileged white male, and it wasn't the right response to my Indigenous children. So I agree with you, Sarah. While I'd like to look back and think I could have done something within the confines of the home and some of that, I think I could have helped. But man, what would it have been like if we had addressed these structures beforehand for our children, so they have hope and dignity to move into adult life and not lose that. So that's certainly part of our response, is how do we help make that happen?
You may know by now that Sarah and I have a new book, So That We and Our Children May Live, Following Jesus in Confronting the Climate Crisis.
We also have a new Substack with the same title, based on the same themes found in that book: ecological justice, decolonization, faith, and where we find hope for our future.
We're excited about this Substack because the writing is more personal and more, I'd say, unfiltered than other writing we've put out there. Did you know, for instance, that Sarah is obsessed with the TV show Supernatural and how it relates to her life? Sarah, I have been really struck and moved by the personal and powerful essays you're writing on this theme for our Substack.
Or did you know that Sherry finds a source for ethical reflection in the apocalyptic show The Walking Dead? I did not know that.
Which, by the way, I introduced to my son at a questionably young age, and he's actually home from college break and is still watching it. Also, I read a lot and I take in a lot of podcasts, and I try to pass along the gems I find from that rather obsessive reading and listening to you in this Substack. So here's how this whole thing works. If you sign up on the Substack link, or if you just click on the Substack link in our show notes, then you get to the Substack page and you sign up, and then the articles will land in your email inbox every week. A few of the articles are going to be free as long as you just sign up. But we're also hoping to raise money for the coalition through this Substack. And so many of the articles are behind a paywall. So for $60 a year, you can have access to all of the articles, and Substack will guide you through that. It's very easy to do.
All proceeds support the work of the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery. We're excited about the work that we're doing and want to share it broadly with all of you in the world. Look forward to seeing you on Substack, where we get to talk about our internal thoughts and reflections, some of them humorous, some of them irreverent. Looking forward to seeing you there. Do you mind? I know this is maybe a little cheesy, but I have to share with you a scripture that is important to me. It was important to my mother. And I think when I was young, I did not have compassion for what she was trying to do, raising children of color in a difficult world. But anyway, here's the scripture. It's Joel chapter 2. It's a promise. I will restore to you the years that the swarming locusts have eaten, the hopper, the destroyer, and the cutter. And I think about that, you know, that every day. And I think about that in terms of, you know, reclaiming those years, the years that the swarming locusts have eaten, that we could find fullness of life for our children, you know, and my own child, who's barely a child anymore, and for all of the little ones. That's a promise of hope for me. And I maybe don't know how to explain that theologically. Sherry, help me.
No, I think I'm very struck by the fact that that was one of your mother's favorite verses, which is really.
Oh, I mean, she claimed it as a promise because she was separated from her children. You know, I lost my mom when I was 13 years old, and I didn't see her again until I was an adult. Yeah. And so there's a story there, but that was one of the verses that she claimed was restoring those years. And I could not understand it then, but I do understand it now.
Mm. You know, I feel sort of compelled to say, and maybe saying this especially for like some of our white listeners who have white children. I might have a white son. But as Sarah knows so well, when he was in fifth grade, he went into a coma. He had turned out he had viral meningitis. And for about 24 hours, we didn't know what was going to happen to him. It was during that time, I'm probably going to feel a little, yeah. It was during that time I remember actually, Sarah, talking to you on the phone and I'm walking around the hospital. I'm outside of the hospital, just walking. I mean, I had barely contained panic going through my body for about 24 to 48 hours. And the phrase that just kept going through my head was every mother's son, every mother's son, every mother's son. And it was this sense of like, I am being initiated into the incredible love and suffering that, I mean, it was a gendered mother, son. I mean, that mothers feel for their sons, or that just parents feel for their children. Like the amount of love and pain I was feeling in that moment, like that is what every parent feels for their child. And how can we have a world where parents are the least likely to have to feel that the suffering I was experiencing right then, that sense of panic, that sense of wondering, was he going to live or die? Was he going to thrive or not? So I say that because I think those of us who have children and love them, no matter what background they're from, can, it's an entry into this work, as I think what I want to say, of how do we build a world where just where children have the best possible chance of surviving and thriving and having that inherent dignity, as you said. So, yeah, thank you. This has been really moving sharing this morning.
I remember that time so vividly. It's like I remember it like it was yesterday. I think of it often, actually, Sherry, and that time, you know, you were talking about how, I don't know, it was like you said, now I understand. You were really talking about how, you know, I was so connected and just desperate for these friends and community members and partners in Suriname. And it was like this desperation. I could not shed it. It was just like, oh my gosh, how am I going to show up? And you told me, oh, I understand. Like now I understand.
Yeah. It was a very visceral desperation. That's a good word for it. It's an initiation into that desperation that you then are like, we have to do what we can to make people feel less desperate.
I will do anything. Yeah. So that crossing the line, is it? Like, I will do anything.
Right.
It's no longer someone else's problem, you know?
Right. That does lead into this question of like, what do you feel is next for your diocese? And, you know, you've repudiated, and I want to also acknowledge the really concrete action you did at the very beginning, but you've repudiated, now what?
Well, that is a really good question. We're asking that ourselves. Obviously, back to even Sarah's points a few moments ago, and I deeply appreciate both of your sharing about focusing this on, you know, working generations ahead. You know, if we're looking to say, what are we setting up? And because I don't know that we're going to make much of a difference in our lifetime, even though there's a lot of separation. The three of us cover several decades here, but I don't know that we're going to see a lot of change, but we've got to start shifting, doing what we can, because I want to be able to think seven generations ahead. You know, what are we going to leave for our children in the future? So that's what we're trying to determine, is how do we best affect structures? And that's our help in talking with the leadership that Sarah is giving to us, our effort to try to build some faithful relationships with Indigenous people within our living environment of certainly Eastern Oregon, but more importantly, to the larger structures of this country. How do we affect the change? And I honestly can't give you details of that, but I think we start looking for the opportunities that present themselves. Mm. And some of them are not going to be as well received trying to affect the cultural changes as maybe our previous work. You know, everybody's more than willing oftentimes to jump in and say, we can sign a document. That's great. Now we all feel better. Let's go home. Let's get back to the norm. And we're trying to say we can't go back anymore. That there is, you know, we're in the liminal state right now, and that liminal threshold of not quite, we can't be comfortable in our frame of reference from the past because we've been exposed to something far greater, far deeper, richer, and far more important, which is the lives of our children, indigenous and white and whoever they are. But how do we help affect that change now? So looking from that threshold space, what's the new land we're going to step into? And we're still trying to discover that. But what we know is it is an exodus. We've got to leave the comfort of our situation in Egypt. And there is another space that we're being invited back into. And I don't know what that's going to be, but the real work is going to be there now. Things like, you know, how do we help affect the change that are important to our indigenous siblings? And some of that is things like dealing with the situation that you all have had podcasts already, Oak Flats. How do we support the work for religious freedom and people's rights in a land that their ancestors have lived for tens and tens of thousands of years? How do we bring salmon back by breaching dams in a place where I just visited my family down in Lewiston yesterday, and you know, boy, talk about a rather conservative group of family down there. The issue didn't come up, which I was thankful for because I didn't want to get into it yesterday. But you know, how do we address and support systemic changes that are very visible like that? But I think we're really wanting to figure out how do we engage with people who know more than we do to affect real systemic issues. How do we change the laws? How do we, you know, as I read the newspaper, for example, a place like Oklahoma right now fighting over sovereignty rights to issue license plates to the members' cars, and the state wanting to say, wait a minute, we're losing money on this deal. Let's change that back. So how do we step into some of those gaps that we can come alongside important issues for our indigenous siblings and really help make a difference? And I think so probably the simplest answer to the question right now is how do we listen intently and make a decision to listen intently to our indigenous partners, and how do we then do the hard work of taking steps that are going to alienate even some of our supporters, and recognizing that now we enter into some of the harder work. We aren't going to get 100% unanimous decision on a piece of paper anymore. We're going to be entering into where it really is a change of lifestyle, and that's going to take some work.
Mm. Well, I sure appreciate that. And I also want to just say, you know, as you're saying, Pat, getting into work that could even alienate supporters, you know, that there is something else on the other side, which is, you know, there is this pressure and angst and tension, but there's also a deepening of relationship, you know, and a fullness of life that is possible through collaboration with the spirit of life. And so, you know, I think to myself, oh my gosh, Sherry and I have been at this for a decade. We raised our kids side by side. I mean, this wasn't the only thing happening. We, you know, we had lives and marriages and families and jobs, and we've been living life together. And so when you were talking about blessed community, I think about that, being part of this blessed community. We talk about that a lot. There's also this possibility of entering into community in a way beyond the superficial, where we're actually joining together. I mean, I don't want to dismiss life before, which, you know, was also community, but I mean, I do think there's this possibility of joyfulness and hope in relationship with each other. And so, Pat, I want to say thank you for that commitment, and also that I plan to know you for the rest of my life, you know.
Yeah, I feel that. I feel now, Pat, that you are a part of my community as well. And it's what a blessing on a Monday morning when I felt a little bit bleary, foggy headed, to now come to this place after this holy conversation we've been having the last hour, to feel again the blessing of being together in this work. And I think, Sarah, of something you said when we did our book launch for Mennonite Church Canada, and a member of my church who was listening in on that remarked upon this. You said, our hope comes in. I think you said something like, our hope comes because we get to be together doing this work. Like, that's, we don't know what our future is going to be, right? It looks kind of hard. And I really appreciated what you said, Pat, about the fact that we're doing the work in faithfulness, knowing we will never actually see the results of our actions, or probably will very rarely see the results of our actions. But in the meantime, we get to do it together. And that's where our hope is. So thank you for this community we formed together this morning.
Well, thank you both. I so deeply respect the work both of you are doing, and I just stand in awe of it, and so thankful that we can be some small part of that work with you as well. So thank you for the privilege of spending this time with both of you this morning. It was just a delight.
Thank you.
This podcast is hosted by us, co-produced by the DD&D Coalition and Anabaptist World.
The opinions expressed here are ours, however, and do not reflect official positions of Anabaptist World.
For more information, go to anabaptistworld.org and dofdmeno.org.
Our theme music is by Micah Peplow and Shannon Kaler. Thank you.